Hello, this is Thelma English again, and I'm going to be reading to you from Book 4 of Virgil's Aeneid, the Robert Fitzgerald translation. You need to have your copy of the Aeneid, the Robert Fitzgerald translation, Aeneid by Virgil, so that you can take notes and what else. This will be Book 4. As you remember, in Book 2 and 3, Aeneas is retelling the story of the fall of Troy and his escape and going from land to land, very similar to what Odysseus does in the Odyssey. And that's been Book 2 and 3 that Queen Dido has been listening to all of this. Now, in Book 4, Dido, we'll learn that she is also called Alyssa. We learn that she is in love. We also learn she has a sister, Anna. And as Dido expresses herself to her sister, Anna, we, the reader, the listener, learn that she is attracted to Aeneas. There's an apparent reconciliation between Juno and Venus. The goddesses are fickle, of course. They contrive to force Aeneas and Dido into a relationship. Now, neither one is concerned with the fate of Dido. She's just a pawn to the goddesses' whims. They don't really care about Dido. So then there's a hunt, there's a big rainstorm, and then there's a cave. And what Dido believes, or Alyssa, believes to be her marriage to Aeneas, and Aeneas quickly forgets his destiny for a little bit. Dido quits working on her city. She thinks Aeneas is going to stay. Jupiter sends Mercury, Hermes, again the second time, to tell him, get on, you've got to go, get going. Aeneas doesn't even want to say goodbye. He departs. Dido, also called Alyssa, curses the Trojans several times, and then she's going to commit suicide at the end of this book on a big funeral pyre. Aeneas leaves some clothing, sword, and she makes a big funeral pyre up high with a bed on it and an effigy, and then she goes up there and stabs herself to death. And then Juno is going to send Iris to set her spirit free by cutting a lock of her hair. So it's kind of a tragic book. Book 4, the Aeneid Book 4. The queen, for all her part, all that evening, ached with longing for her heart's blood fed, a wound of inward fire eating her away. The manhood of the man, his pride of birth, came home to her time and time again. His looks, because he was cute, his words remained with her to haunt her mind, and desire for him gave her no rest. When dawn swept earth with Phoebus's torch and burned away night gloom and damp, this queen, far gone and ill, confided to the sister of her heart, "My sister Anna, quandaries and dreams have come to frighten me. Such dreams! Think what a stranger yesterday found lodging in our house. How princely, how courageous, what a soldier! I can believe him in the line of gods, and this is no delusion. Telltale fear betrays inferior souls. What scenes of war fought to the bitter end he pictured for us. What buffetings awaited him at sea! Had I not set my face against marriage, after my first love died and failed me, left me barren and bereaved and sick to death at the mere thought of torch and bridal bed, I could perhaps give way in this one case to frailty. I shall say it. Since that time, Sychaeus, my poor husband, met his fate. Remember, her evil brother killed her husband? And blood my brother shed stained our hearth gods. This man alone has wrought upon me so, and moved my soul to yield. I recognize the signs of the old flame, of old desire. But, O chaste life, before I break your vows, I pray that earth may open up, gape for me down to its depth, or the omnipotent one, with one stroke, blast me to the shades, pale shades of Erebus and the dark, deep world of night. So we learn that Dido probably took some type of a vow for Sychaeus, her husband, and said she wouldn't marry again because she's thinking of breaking that vow. The man who took me to himself in youth has taken all my love. May that man keep it, hold it forever with him in the tomb. So Dido wants to stay true to her dead husband, but she can't help it. Of course, the goddesses are against her, so of course she can't. At this she wept and wet her breasts with tears, but Anna answered, "Dearer to your sister than daylight is. Will you wear out your life, young as you are, in solitary mourning, never to know sweet children, or the crown of joy that Venus brings? Do you believe this matter to the dust, to ghosts in tombs? Granted, no suitors up to now have moved you, neither in Libya nor before, in Tyre, Iarbus you rejected, and the others, chieftains bred by the land of Africa, their triumphs have enriched. Will you contend, even against a welcome love? Have you considered in whose lands you settled here? One on one frontier, the Getulians, their cities, people invincible in war, with wild Numidian horsemen and the offshore banks, the Syrtes on the other, desert sands, bone dry where fierce Barcaean Numids range. Or need I speak of future wars brought on from Tyr and the menace of your brother? Surely by dispensation of the gods, and backed by Juno's will, the ships from Ilium held their course this way on the wind. Sister, what a great city you'll see rising here, and what a kingdom from this royal match. So Anna thinks Dido should marry Aeneas, and finish the city. With Trojan soldiers as companions in arms, by what exploits will Punic glory grow? And of course, that's Carthage. Only ask the indulgence of the gods. With them, win them with offerings. Give your guests ease, and contrive reasons for delay. So try to stall them so they don't leave. While winter gales rage, drenched Orion storms at sea, and their ships damaged still, face iron skies. So go make him fall in love with you while they have to be wintering over here. This counsel fanned the flame already kindled, giving her hesitant sister hope, and set her free of scruple. Visiting the shrines, they begged for grace at every altar first, then put choice rams and ewes to ritual death for Ceres, giver of laws, Father Lyacus, Phoebus, and for Juno most of all, who has the bonds of marriage in her keeping. Dido herself, splendidly beautiful, holding a shallow cup, tips out the wine on a white, shining heifer between the horns, or gravely in the shadow of the gods, approaches opulent altars. Through the day she brings new gifts, and when the breasts are opened, pours over organs living still for signs. Alas, what darkened minds have soothsayers. Okay, so as they are being sacrificed, the seers are looking through the organs in the poor animal who is still alive, looking for signs. And that author says, alas, what darkened minds have soothsayers. I must agree. What good are shrines and vows to maddened lovers? The inward fire eats the soft marrow away as the internal wound bleeds on in silence. Unlucky Dido, burning in her madness, roamed through all the city, and what was it like? And here we have an extended simile. As she's running in her madness through all the city, like a doe hit by an arrow shot from far away by a shepherd hunting in the Cretan woods, hit by surprise, nor could the hunter see his flying steel had fixed itself in her. But though she runs for life through copse and glade, the fatal shaft clings to her side. Now Dido took Aeneas with her among her buildings, showed her Sidonian wealth, her walls prepared, and tried to speak, but in mid-speech grew still. When the day waned, she wanted to repeat the banquet as before, to hear once more in her wild need the throes of Ilium, and once more hung on the narrator's words. Afterward, when all the guests were gone, and the dim moon in turn had quenched her flight, and setting stars weighed weariness to sleep, alone she mourned in the great empty hall, and pressed her body on the couch he left. She heard him still, though absent, heard and saw him, or she would hold Ascanius in her lap. And of course, Ascanius, I don't know if this is the real one or still Cupid, enthralled by him, the image of his father, as though by this ruse to appease a love beyond all telling. Towers half-built rose no further, men no longer trained in arms or toiled to make harbors and battlements impregnable. Projects were broken off, laid over in the menacing huge walls with cranes unmoving stood against the sky. So Dido has stopped all the building projects in her preoccupation with Aeneas. As soon as Jove's dear consort saw the lady prey to such illness, and her reputation standing no longer in the way of passion, Saturn's daughter, that's Juno, said to Venus, "Wondrous! Covered yourself with glory, have you not, you and your boy, Cupid, and won such prizes, too. Divine power is something to remember if by collusion of two gods one mortal woman is brought low. I am not, and now, so continuing, this is Juno talking to Venus, I'm not blind. Your fear of our new walls has not escaped me. Fear and mistrust of Carthage at her height. But how far will it go? What do you hope for, being so contentious? Why do we not arrange eternal peace and formal marriage? Why don't we let Dido and Aeneas rule together here? Do you have your heart's desire? Dido in love? Dido consumed with passion to her core. Why not, then, rule this people side by side with equal authority? And let the queen wait on her Phrygian, her Trojan lord. Let her consign into your hand the Tyrians as a dowry. Now Venus knew this talk was all pretense, all to divert the future power from Italy to Libya. And she answered, Who would be so mad, so foolish as to shun that prospect, or prefer war with you? That is, provided fortune is on the side of your proposal. The fates here are perplexing. Would one city satisfy Jupiter's will for Tyrians and Trojan exiles? Does he approve a union and a mingling of these races? You are his consort. You have every right to sound him out. Go on, and I'll come too. But regal Juno pointedly replied, that task will rest with me. Just now, as to the need of the moment and the way to meet it, listen, and I'll explain in a few words. Aeneas and Dido, in her misery, plan hunting in the forest, when the Titan sun comes up with rays to light the world. While beaters in excitement ring the glens, my gift will be a black rain cloud, and hail, a downpour, and I'll shake heaven with thunder. The company will scatter, lost in gloom, as Dido and the Trojan captain come to one same cavern. I shall be on hand, and if I can be certain you are willing, there I shall marry them and call her his. A wedding this will be. Then Cytherea, not disinclined, so Venus, nodded to Juno's plea, Hera, and smiled at the stratagem now given way. Dawn came up meanwhile from the ocean stream, and in the early sunshine from the gates, picked a huntsman issued, wide-meshed nets and snares, broad spearheads for big game, Massilian horsemen trooping with hounds in packs keen on the scent. But Dido lingered in her hall as Punic, Carthaginian, nobles waited, and her mettlesome hunter stood nearby, cavorting in gold and scarlet, chomping his foam-flecked bridle. At long last, the queen appeared with courtiers and a crowd. A short Sidonian cloak edged in embroidery caught about her. At her back, a quiver, so she's wearing the new coat that was Helen's. Caught about her, at her back, a quiver sheathed in gold, her hair tied up in gold, and a brooch of gold pinning her scarlet dress. Phrygians came in her company as well, and Iulus, joyous at the scene, the little boy. Resplendent above the rest, Aeneas walked to meet her, to join his retinue with hers. He seemed, and what did he seem like? Another simile. She sees Aeneas walking toward her. He seemed... Think of the Lord Apollo in the spring, when he leaves wintering in Lycia by Xanthus's torrent for his mother's isle of Delos to renew the festival around his altars. Cretans, Dioropes, and painted Agastherians raise a shout, but the god walks the Cytherean ridge alone and smooths his hair, binds it in a fronded laurel, braids it in gold, and shafts ring on his shoulders. So she's comparing Aeneas's looks to Apollo's. So elated and aswift, Aeneas walked, with sunlit grace upon him. Soon the hunters, riding in company to high pathless hills, saw mountain goats shoot down from a rocky peak and scamper on the ridges toward the plain. Deer left the slopes, herding in clouds of dust in flight across the open lands. Alone, the boy Ascanius, delightedly riding his eager horse amid the lowland vales, outran both goats and deer. Could he only meet amid the harmless game some foaming boar or a tawny lion down from the mountainside. Meanwhile, in heaven began a rolling thunder, and soon the storm broke, pouring rain and hail. Then Tyrians and Trojans in alarm, with Venus's Dardan grandson, her grandson Ascanius, ran for cover here and there in the wilderness as freshets coursed from the high hills. Now, to the selfsame cave came Dido and the captain of the Trojans, so they kind of bump into each other in the same cave. Primal Earth herself and nuptial means marriage, and nuptial Juno opened the ritual. Torches of lightning blazed. High heaven became witness to the marriage, and nymphs cried out wild hymns from a mountaintop. That day was the first cause of death and first of sorrow. Dido had no further qualms as to impressions given and set abroad. She thought no longer of a secret love, but called it marriage. Thus, under that name, she hid her fault. Now, in no time at all, through all the African cities, rumor goes, and rumor here is metamorphosed into a, like a person. Rumor goes, nimble as quicksilver among evils. Rumor thrives on motion, stronger for the running, lowly at first through fear, then rearing high, she treads the land and hides her head in cloud. As people fable it, the earth, her mother, furious among the gods, bore a late sister to the giants Coesus and Enceladus, giving her speed on foot and as the wind and on the wind. So Coesus was a Titan. He was the father of the Latona. monstrous, deformed, titanic, pinioned with an eye beneath for every body feather, and to say as many tongues and buzzing mouths as eyes, as many pricked up ears, by night. So this is rumor personified, how ugly she is. Shrieking through darkness, and she never turns her eyelids down to sleep. By day she broods on the alert on rooftops or in towers, bringing great cities fear, harping on lies and slander, even-handedly with truth. In those days, rumor took an evil joy at filling countrysides with whispers, whispers, gossip of what was done and never done, how this Aeneid landed Trojan-born, how Dido in her beauty graced his company, then how they reveled all the winter long, unmindful of the realm, prisoners of lust. These tales the scabrous goddess put about on men's lips everywhere, the goddess rumor. Her twisting course took her to King Iarbas. This is an African king who had been a suitor to Dido. King Iarbas, whom she set ablaze with anger, piled on top of anger, son of Jupiter Hammon by a nymph, a ravished Garamantian, this prince had built the god 100 giant shrines, 100 altars, each with holy fires, alight by night and day, sentries on watch, the ground enriched by victims' blood, the doors festooned in flowering wreaths. Before his altars, King Iarbas, crazed by the raw story, stood, they say, amid the presences, with supplicating hands, pouring out prayer. So this jealous suitor is complaining to the gods. All-powerful Jove, he says, line 280, to whom the feasting Moors at ease on colored couches tip their wine. Do you see this? Are we then fools to fear you throwing down your bolts? Those dazzling fires of lightning, are they aimless in the clouds and rumbling thunder meaningless? This woman who turned up in our country and laid down a tiny city at a price, to whom I gave a beach to plow and on my terms, after refusing to marry me, has taken Aeneas to be the master in her realms. In her realm. And now Sir Paris with his men. And so this is Sir Paris. Paris was, of course, the Trojan prince who was quite a sissy. So he's calling him a Sir Paris, Aeneas. And now Sir Paris with his men, half men, his chin and perfumed hair tied up in a Maeonian bonnet, takes possession. As for ourselves, here we are bringing gifts into these shrines, supposedly your shrines, talking to the gods, hugging that empty fable. Pleas like this from the man clinging to his altars reached the ears of the Almighty. Now he turned his eyes upon the queen's town and the lovers, careless of their good name. Then he spoke to Mercury, Hermes, assigning to him a mission. So Jove is sending Mercury on a mission. Son, bestir yourself. Call up the zephyrs, that's the west wind. Take to your wings and glide. Approach the Dardanian, Aeneas, captain, where he tarries, wrapped in Tyrian Carthage, losing sight of future towns the fates ordain. So Aeneas has forgot that he's supposed to go to Rome. Correct him. Carry my speech to him on the running winds. No son like this did his enchanting mother promise to us, nor such did she deliver twice from peril at the hands of Greeks. He was to be the ruler of Italy, potential empire, armorer of war, to father men from Teucer's noble blood and bring the whole world under law's dominion. That would be the Romans. If glories be won by deeds like these, cannot arouse him. If he will not strive for his own honor, does he begrudge his son? So, she says Venus didn't save Aeneas from the Greeks twice for this, for him to piddle around with a girl. So for his own honor, his own teammate, does he begrudge his son? So if Aeneas doesn't get going and go found Rome, then how can Ascanius inherit? Ascanius, the high strongholds of Rome. What has he in mind? What hope to make him stay amid a hostile race and lose from view Ausonian progeny, Italy, Lavinian lands? The man should sail. That is the whole point. Let this be what you tell him, as from me. He finished and fell silent. Line 325. Mercury, Hermes, made ready to obey the great command of his great father. And at first he tied on the golden sandals, winged, that high in air transport him over seas or over land, abreast of gale winds. And he took the wand with which he summons pale souls out of Orcus, the underworld, and ushers others to the undergloom. Because remember, Hermes, Mercury, is the escort to the underworld. And open dead men's eyes. This wand in hand, he can drive winds before him, swimming down among the storm cloud. Now aloft, he saw the craggy flanks and crown of patient Atlas, giant Atlas balancing the sky upon his peak, his pine-forested head in vapor cowled, beaten by wind and rain. Snow lay upon his shoulders, rills cascaded down his ancient chin and beard a bristle, caked with ice. Here Mercury's of Cyllene. Cyllene is the highest mountain in the Peloponnese, and that's supposed to be the birthplace of Mercury, Hermes. Here Mercury of Cyllene hovered first on even wings, then down he plummeted to sea level and flew on like a low-flying gull that skims. How did he fly? Like a low-flying gull that skims the shallows and rocky coast where fish ply close inshore. So, like a gull between the earth and sky, the progeny of Cyllene, this is Hermes, Mercury, on the wing from his maternal grandsire, split the winds to the sandbars of Libya. Alighting tiptoe on the first hutments, there he found Aeneas laying foundations for new towers and homes. So Aeneas is now helping to build Carthage. Laying foundations for new towers and homes, he noted well the sword hilt the man wore, adorned with yellow jasper, and the cloak aglow with Tyrian dye, purple, upon his shoulders, gifts of the wealthy queen, who had inwoven gold thread in the fabric. Mercury took him to task at once. So this is Mercury, Hermes, talking to Aeneas. Is it for you to lay the stones for Carthage's high walls, tame husband that you are, just called him a wimp, and build their city, oblivious of your own world, your own kingdom, from bright Olympus, he that rules the gods and turns the earth and heaven by his power. He and no other sent me to you, told me to bring this message on the running winds. What have you in mind? What hope wasting your days in Libya? If futures, histories, glories do not affect you, if you will not strive for your own honor, Time, think of Ascanius. Think of the expectations of your heir. Okay, remember Rome. Ilius, to whom the Italian realm, the land of Rome, are due. And Mercury, as he spoke, departed from the visual field of mortals to a great distance, ebbed in subtle air. Amazed and shocked to the bottom of his soul by what his eyes had seen, Aeneas felt his hackles rise, his voice choke in his throat. Oh no, what have I done? I gotta leave. As the sharp admonition and command from heaven had shaken him awake, he now burned only to be gone, to leave that land of the sweet life behind. Line 385. What can he do? How tell the impassioned queen and hope to win her over? What opening shall he choose? This way and that he let his mind dart, testing alternatives, running through every one. He's trying to think of what he will say. And as he pondered, this seemed the better tactic. He called in Menestheus, Sergestus, and stalwart Serestus, telling them, he's going to sneak off. Get the fleet ready for sea, but quietly, and collect the men on shore. Lay in ship stores and gear. For a change of plan, they were to keep it secret, seeing the excellent Dido had no warning that such love could be cut short. He would himself look for the right occasion. The easiest time to speak, the way to do it. The Trojans, to a man, gladly obeyed. The queen, for her part, felt some plot afoot quite soon. So Dido is suspicious. For who deceives a woman in love? She caught wind of a change, being in fear of what had seemed her safety. Evil rumor, shameless as before, brought word to her in her distracted state of ships being rigged and trimmed for sailing. Furious at her wit's end, she traversed the whole city, all aflame with rage, like a Bacchante driven wild by emblems shaken. So by like a worshipper of Bacchus, who would be a wild and go into a frenzy. When the mountain revels of the odd year possess her, when the cry of Bacchus rises and Cytherean calls all through the shouting night, thus it turned out she was the first to speak and charge Aeneas. You even hoped to keep me in the dark as to this outrage, did you? Two-faced man, and slip away in silence. Can our love not hold you? Can the pledge we gave not hold you? Can Dido not, now sure to die in pain? Even in winter weather, must you toil with ships and fret to launch against high winds for the open sea? Oh, heartless, tell me now if you were not in search of alien lands and new strange homes, if ancient Troy remained, would ships put out for Troy on these big seas? Did you go to get away from me? Do you go to get away from me? I beg you, by dry these tears by your own right hand, since I have left my wretched self nothing but that, yes, by the marriage that we entered on. If ever I did well and you were grateful, or found some sweetness in a gift from me, have pity now on a declining house. Put this plan by, I beg you, if a prayer is not yet out of place. Because of you, Libyans and nomad kings detest me. My own Tyrians are hostile. Because of you, I lost my integrity, and that admired name by which alone I made my way once toward the stars. To whom do you abandon me, a dying woman, guest that you are? The only name now left from that of husband. Why do I live on? Shall I, until my brother Pygmalion comes to put my walls down, remember her evil brother Pygmalion who killed her husband Sychaeus, or the Gaetulian Iarbas leads me captive, that's the suitor, who she told no, who now hates her. If at least there were a child by you for me to care for, a little one to play in my courtyard, and give me back Aeneas in spite of all, I should not feel utterly defeated, utterly bereft. So she's kind of wishing, if only there were a child. She ended there. The man, by Jove's command, held fast his eyes and fought down the emotion in his heart. At length he answered, "So this is Aeneas to Dido. As for myself, be sure I shall never deny all you can say, Your Majesty, of what you were meant to me, of what you meant to me. Nor will the memory of Elissa, Dido, stale for me while I can still remember my own life, and the spirit rules my body. As to the event, a few words. Do not think I meant to be deceitful and slip away. I never held the torches of a bridegroom, nor entered upon a pact of marriage. So she said we were married, and he's just now saying, I never actually married you. If fate permitted me to spend my days by my own lights and make the best of things according to my wishes, first of all, I should look after Troy and the loved relics left me of my people. If I had my own way, I'd be back in Troy. Priam's great hall should stand again. I should have restored the tower of Pergamum for Trojans in defeat. But now it is the rich Italian land Apollo tells me I must make for. Italy, named by his oracles. There is my love. There is my country. If, as a Phoenician, you are so given to the charms of Carthage, Libyan city that it is, then tell me, why begrudge the Teucrians new lands for homesteads in Ausonia, Italy? Are we not entitled, too, to look for realms abroad? Night never veils the earth in damp and darkness. Fiery stars never ascend the east, but in my dreams my father's troubled ghost admonishes and frightens me. Then, too, each night thoughts come of young Ascanius, my dear boy wronged, defrauded of his kingdom, Hesperian lands of destiny, and Italy. And now the god's interpreter, sent by Jove himself, that's Hermes, Mercury, I swear it to you by your head and mine, has brought commands down through the racing winds. I say with my own eyes in full daylight, I saw him entering the building. With my very ears I drank his message in. So please, no more of these appeals that set us both afire. I sail for Italy, not of my own free will." That's the end of his speech. During all this, line 500, she, Dido, had been watching him, with face averted, looking him up and down in silence, as she burst out raging now. Now she's really mad. This is Dido talking to Aeneas. "No goddess was your mother. Dardanus was not the founder of your family." Like, Dardanus was the son of Jupiter and founded Troy. So she just says, none of this can be true. "No goddess was your mother. Dardanus was not the founder of your family. Liar and cheat. Some rough Caucasian cliff begot you on flint. Hyrcanian tigress." So this is like an icky, like you're really just lowborn. "Hyrcanian tigresses tended their teats to you like some lion raised you. Why should I palter? Why still hold back for more indignity? Sigh, did he while I wept, or look at me, or yield a tear, or pity her who loved him? What shall I say first with so much to say? The time is past when either supreme Juno or the Saturnian father viewed these things with justice. Faith can never be secure. I took the man in, thrown up upon this coast in dire need, and in my madness then contrived a place for him in my domain, rescued his lost fleet, saved his shipmates' lives. Oh, I am swept away by burning by furies. Now the prophet Apollo, now his oracles, now the god's interpreter, if you please, sent down by Jove himself, brings through the air his formidable commands. What fit employment for heaven's high powers? What anxieties to plague serene immortals? I shall not detain you or dispute your story. So, oh my goodness, if the gods are talking to you, Don't let little me stop you. Go, go after Italy on the sailing winds. Look for your kingdom. Cross the deep swell sea. If divine justice counts for anything, I hope and pray that on some grinding reef midway at sea, you'll drink your punishment and call on Dido's name. From far away, I shall come after you with my black fires, and when cold death has parted body from soul, I shall be everywhere a shade to haunt you. You will pay for this, unconscionable. I shall hear. The news will reach me even among the lowest of the dead. At this abruptly she broke off and ran in sickness from his sight and the light of day, leaving him at a loss, alarmed and mute with all he meant to say. The maids in waiting caught her as she swooned and carried her to bed in her marble chamber. Line 545. Duty bound, because Aeneas is a good Roman, Aeneas, though he struggled with desire to calm and comfort her in all her pain, to speak to her and turn her mind from grief, and though he sighed his heart out, shaken still with love of her, yet took the course heaven gave him and went back to the fleet. Then with a will the Teucrians fell to work and launched the ships along the whole shore. Slick with tar each hull took to the water. Eager to get away, the sailors brought oar boughs out of the woods with leaves still on and oaken logs unhewn. And now you could see them issuing from the town to the water's edge in streams. What was it like? As when, aware of winter, ants will pillage a mound of spelt to store it in their granary over fields, the black battalion moves, and through the grass, on a narrow trail, they carry off the spoil. That's what it was like. Some put their shoulders to the enormous weight of a trundled grain, while some pull stragglers on and castigate delay. Their to and fro of labor makes the whole track come alive. At that sight, what were your emotions, Dido? Sighing how deeply, looking out and down from your high tower on the seething shore, where all the harbor filled before your eyes with bustle and shout. Unconscionable love, to what extremes will you not drive our hearts? She now felt driven to weep again to move him, if she could, by supplication, humbling her pride before her love, to leave nothing untried, not to die needlessly. And now she's asking her sister to stall Aeneas. Anna, you see the arc of waterfront all in a commotion? They come crowding in from everywhere. The spread canvas calls for wind. The happy crews have garlanded the sterns. If I could brace myself for this great sorrow, sister, I can endure it too. One favor, even so, you may perform for me. Since that deserter chose you for his friend and trusted you, even with private thoughts, since you alone know when he may be reached, go, intercede with our proud enemy. Remind him that I took no oath at all with Danaans to destroy the Trojan race. I sent no ship to Pergamum, nor did I profane his father Anchises' dust and shade. So she wants her sister Anna to go tell him, I'm not like a Greek, your enemy. Why will he not allow my prayers to fall on his unpitying ears? Where is he racing? Let him bestow one last gift on his mistress, this to await fair winds and easier flight. Now I no longer plead the bond he broke of our old marriage, nor do I ask that he should live without his dear love, Latium, Italy, or yield his kingdom. Time is all I beg, mere time, a respite and breathing space for madness to subside in, while my fortune teaches me how to take defeat and grieve. Pity your sister. This is the end. This favor, to be repaid with interest when I die. She pleaded in such terms, and such in tears. Her sorrowing sister brought him, time and again. But no tears moved him. No one's voice would he attend to tractably. The fates opposed it. God's will blocked the man's once kindly ears. And, what was it like? And, just as when the north winds from the Alps, this way and that, contend among themselves to tear away an oak tree, hale with age, the wind and cree try, and the buffeted trunk showers high foliage to the earth, but holds on bedrock, for the roots go down as far into the underworld as cresting boughs go up into heaven's air. Just so this captain, Aeneas, buffeted by a gale of pleas from Anna, this way and that way, dinned all the day long, felt their moving power in his great heart, and yet his will stood fast. Tears fell in vain. On Dido in her desolation now, terror grew at her fate. She prayed for death, being heartsick at the mere sight of heaven, that she more surely would perform the act and leave the daylight. Now she saw before her a thing one shudders to recall. On altars fuming with incense, where she placed her gifts, the holy water blackened, the spilt wine turned into blood and mire. So Dido's offerings are all rejected. all the offerings to the god. The spilt wine turned into blood and mire. Line 630. Of this she spoke to no one, not to her sister even. Then, too, within the palace was a marble shrine devoted to her one-time lord, a place she held in wondrous honor, all festooned with snowy fleeces and green festive boughs. From this she now thought voices could be heard and words could be made out, her husband's words, calling her when midnight hushed the earth, and lonely on the rooftops the night owl seemed to lament in melancholy, sad notes, prolonged to a doleful cry. And then, besides the riddling words of seers in ancient days, foreboding sayings made her thrill with fear. In nightmare, fevered, she was hunted down by pitiless Aeneas, so she's having bad dreams, and she seemed deserted always, unaccompanied always, on a long journey, looking for her Tyrians in desolate landscapes. As Pentheus gone mad, Pentheus was the king of Thebes, who was slain by some Maenads, followers of Bacchus, so he went mad. As Pentheus gone mad sees the oncoming Eumenides and sees a double sun and double Thebes appear, or as when, hounded on the stage, Orestes runs from a mother armed with burning brands, with serpents hellish black, and in the doorway squat the avenging ones, the Furies. So broken in mind by suffering, Dido caught her fatal madness and resolved to die. She pondered time and means, then visiting her mournful sister, covered up her plan with a calm look, a clear and hopeful brow. "Sister, be glad for me. I've found a way to bring him back, or free me of desire. Near to the ocean boundary, near sundown, the Asiopes, farthest territory lies, where giant Atlas turns the sphere of heaven, studded with burning stars. From there a priestess of Massilian stock." These are people, has come. So these are people that are west of Carthage, and the western maidens, this is a place guarded by dragons. "She had pointed out to me, custodian of that shrine, named for the daughters of the West, Hesperides." That is the Greek idea of heaven, Hesperides. "And it is she who fed the dragon, guarding well the holy boughs, with honey dripping slow and drowsy poppy. Chanting her spells, she undertakes to free what hearts she wills, but to inflict on others duress of sad desires, to arrest the flow of rivers, make the stars move backward, call up the spirits of deep night. You'll see earth shift and rumble underfoot, and ash trees walk down mountainsides. Dearest, I swear before the gods and by your own sweet self, it is against my will that I resort for weaponry to magic powers. In secret, build up a pyre in the inner court under the open sky, and place in it the arms that faithless man left in my chamber." So Dido's telling her sister Anna, build up a big funeral pyre and put the armor that Aeneas gave me, put that on it. "The arms that faithless man left in my chamber, all his clothing, and the marriage bed on which I came to grief, solace for me to annihilate all vestige of the man. Vile as he is, my priestess shows me this." Line 690. While she was speaking, cheek and brow grew pale, but Anna could not think her sister cloaked a suicide in these unheard-of rites. She failed to see how great her madness was, and feared no consequence more grave than at Sychaeus's death. So, as commanded, she made the preparations. For her part, the queen, seeing the pyre in her inmost court, erected huge and pitch-pine and sawn ilex, hung all the place under the sky with wreaths, and crowned it with funeral cypress boughs. On the pyre's top she put a sword he left with clothing, and an effigy. So an effigy, she puts a sword and then an effigy of Aeneas, something that looks like him, on the pyre, like she's burning him up. Her mind fixed now ahead of what would come. Around the pyre stood altars, and the priestess, hair unbound, called in a voice of thunder upon 300 gods, on Erebus, on Chaos, and on Triple Hecate. These are goddesses of the underworld, witchcraft, and of the moon. Three-faced Diana. Then she sprinkled drops, purportedly, from the fountain of Avernus. Rare herbs were brought out, reaped at the new moon by skiths of bronze and juicy with a milk of dusky venom. Then the rare love charm of Orcal, torn from the brow of a birthing foal and snatched away before the mother found it. This is like an incantation, a whole slew of rare things that she puts together. Dido herself, with consecrated grain in her pure hands as she went near the altars, freed 1 foot from sandal straps, let fall her dress ungirdled, and now, sworn to death, called on the gods and stars that knew her fate. She prayed then to whatever power may care, and comprehending herself, justice for the grief of lovers bound unequally by love. The night had come, and weary in every land, men's bodies took the boon of peaceful sleep. The woods and the wild seas had quieted at that hour, when the stars are in mid-course and every field is still. Cattle and birds with vivid wings that haunt the limpid lakes, or nests in thickets in the country places, all were asleep under the silent night. Not, though, the agonized Phoenician queen. She never slackened into sleep, and never allowed the tranquil night to rest upon her eyelids or within her heart. Her pain redoubled, love came on again, devouring her, and on her bed she tossed in a great surge of anger. So awake she pressed these questions, musing to herself. Look now, what can I do? Turn once again to the old suitors, only to be laughed at, baying a marriage with Numidians who I disdained so often? Then what? Trail the Ilian ships and follow like a slave commands of Trojans, seeing them so agreeable in view of past assistance and relief, so thoughtful their unshaken gratitude? Suppose I wished it. Who permits or takes aboard their proud ships, one they so dislike? Poor lost soul, do you not yet grasp or feel the treachery of the line of Laomedon, the Trojans? What then, am I to go alone, companion of the exultant sailors in their flight? Or shall I set out in their wake, with Tyrians, with all my crew close at my side, and send the men I barely tore away from Tyre to sea again, making them hoist their sails to more sea winds? No. Die as you deserve, given pain quietus with a steel blade. Sister, you are the one who gave way to my tears in the beginning, burdened a mad queen with sufferings, and thrust me on my enemy. It was not given me to lead my life without new passion, innocently the way wild creatures live, and not to touch these depths. The vow I took to the ashes of Sychaeus was not kept. So Dido, Elissa, is very upset that she didn't keep her vow to her dead husband. So she broke out afresh in bitter mourning, line 770. On his high stern deck, Aeneas, now quite certain of departure, everything ready, took the boon of sleep. In dream, the figure of a god returned with looks reproachful as before. He seemed again to warn him, being like Mercury in every way, in voice, in golden hair, and in the bloom of youth. So this is, for the second time now, Mercury is coming to him, telling him to get going. Son of the goddess, so this is Mercury, sleep away this crisis. Can you still? Do you not see the dangers growing around you? Madmen, from now on, can you not hear the offshore west wind blow? The woman hatches plots and drastic actions in her heart, resolved on death now, whipping herself on to heights of anger. Will you not be gone in flight, while flight is still within your power? Soon you will see the offing boil with ships and glare with torches. Soon again the waterfront will be alive with fires, if dawn comes while you linger in this country. Ha! Come break the spell. Woman's a thing forever fitful and forever changing. So, in other words, Mercury implies they'll come down and burn your ships up if you don't leave, and that women are quite fickle. At this, he merged into the darkness. Then, as the abrupt phantom filled him with fear, Aeneas broke from sleep and roused his crewmen. Up! Turn out now! Oarsmen, take your thwarts! Shake out sail! Look here! For the second time, a god from heaven's high air is girding me to hasten our breakaway, to goading me to hasten our breakaway, to cut the cables. Holy one, whatever god you are, we go with you. We act on your command most happily. Be near, graciously help us, make the stars and heaven propitious ones. He pulled his sword a flash out of its sheath and struck at the stern hawser. All the men were gripped by his excitement to be gone, and hauled and hustled. Ships cast off their moorings, and an array of hulls hid inshore water as oarsmen churned up foam and swept to sea. So they even have a big water supply. Line 810. Soon early dawn, quitting the saffron bed of old Timothus, cast new light on earth, and as air grew transparent from her tower, the queen caught sight of the ships on the seaward reach, with sails full and the wind astern. She knew the waterfront, now empty, barren of oarsmen, beating her lovely breast 3 times, 4 times, and tearing her golden hair. Oh, Jupiter, she said, will this man go? Will he have mocked my kingdom, stranger that he was and is? Will they not snatch up arms and follow him from every quarter of the town, and dock hands tear our ships from moorings? On, be quick with torches, give out arms, unship the oars. What am I saying? Where am I? What madness takes me out of myself? Dido, poor soul, your evil doing has come home to you. She's talking to herself. Then was the right time when you offered him a royal scepter. See the good faith and honor of one they say bears with him everywhere the hearth gods of his country, one who bore his father spent with age upon his shoulders. Could I not then have torn him limb from limb and flung the pieces on the sea? His company, even Ascanius, could I not have minced and served up to his father at a feast? So Dido's contemplating what evil she could have done, very much like what Atreus did, cut your kids up and serve them to you at a feast. The luck of battle might have been in doubt. So let it have been. Whom had I to fear being sure to die? I could have carried torches into his camp, piled passageways with flame, annihilated father and son and followers, and given my own life on top of all. O sun, scanning with flame all works of earth, and thou, O Juno, witness and go-between of my long miseries, and Hecate, screeching for a night at crossroads in the city, and thou, avenging furies and all gods on whom Alyssa, Dido, dying may call, take notice, overshadow this hell with your high power, as I deserve, and hear my prayer, if by necessity that impious wretch must find his haven and come safe to land, if so Jove's destinies require, you know, that Aeneas goes and founds Italy, she's praying for vengeance. And this his end in view must stand, yet all the same, when hard beset in war by a brave people, forced to go outside his boundaries and torn from Iulius, let him beg assistance, let him see unmerited deaths of those around, and with him, and accepting peace on unjust terms, let him not even so enjoy his kingdom, or the life he longs for, but fall in battle before his time, and lie unburied upon the sand. So she's wishing vengeance for him, that he dies, has no friends, nobody helps him, and that he dies alone, you know, on the sand, and doesn't get buried. This I implore, this is my last cry, as my blood flows. Then, O my Tyrians, besiege with hate his progeny and all his race to come. And this line is important, line 865 and 866, because this is Dido praying that the Carthaginians will hate Aeneas's people, who, of course, are going to be the Romans. And, of course, the Punic Wars were when the Carthaginians fought the Romans, and the Romans won, and the Romans even went down to Carthage and salted the land so nothing could grow there. They hated them so much. And, of course, this is going, you know, almost 1,000 years back and saying this is the cause of those Carthaginian or Punic Wars, because Dido hated Aeneas. So besiege with hate his progeny and all his race to come. Make this your offering to my dust. No love, no pact must be between our peoples. No, but rise up from my bones, avenging spirit. Harry with fire and sword the Dardan, Trojan, countrymen, now or hereafter, at whatever time that strength will be afforded. Coast with coast in conflict I implore, and sea with sea, and arm with arms, may they contend in war themselves, and all the children of their children. So Dido is foreseeing here Punic Wars, and of course Virgil's telling it 1,000 from the time of Christ, looking back as though he's foretelling it. But this is actually all in the past. Now she took thought of one way or another at the first chance to end her hated life, and briefly spoke to Barque, who had been Sychaeus's nurse, her own an urn of ash long held in her ancient fatherland. Dear nurse, tell Sister Anna to come here, and have her quickly bedew herself with running water before she brings our victims for atonement. Let her come that way. And you, too, put on pure wool around your brows. I have a mind to carry out that rite to Stygian Jove that I have readied here, and put an end to my distress, committing to the flames the peer of that miserable Dardan. Aeneas. At this, with the old woman's eagerness, Barque hurried away, so the slave goes away, and Dido's heart beat wildly at the enormous thing afoot. She rolled her bloodshot eyes, her quivering cheeks were flecked with red as her sick pallor grew before her coming death. Into the court she burst her way, then at her passion's height she climbed the pyre and bared the Dardan, Aeneas, the Dardan sword, a gift desired once, for no such need. Her eyes now on the Trojan clothing there, and the familiar bed, she paused a little, weeping a little, mindful, then lay down and spoke her last words. Line 904. Remnants dear to me, while God and fate allowed it, take this breath and give me respite from these agonies. I lived my life out to the very end and past the stages fortune had appointed. Now my tall shade goes to the underworld. I built a famous town, saw my great walls, avenged my husband, made my hostile brother pay for his crime. Happy, alas, too happy, if only the Dardanian keels had never breached our coast, if only the Trojans had never come here. And here she kissed the bed. I die unavenged, she said, but let me die. This way, a blessed relief to go into the undergloom. Let the cold Trojan far at sea drink in this conflagration and take with him the omen of my death. So, and with these words, her household people saw her crumple over the steel blade. So she stabs herself. And the blade afresh with red blood drenched her hands. So Dido just stabbed herself with Aeneas' sword. A scream pierced the high chambers. Now through the shocked city, rumor went rioting as wails and sobs with women's outcry echoed in the palace. And heaven's high air gave back the beating din as though all Carthage or old Tyre fell to storming enemies. And out of hand, flames billowed on the roofs of men and gods. Her sister heard in trembling, feet with terror lacerated. Her face, beating her breast, ran through the crowd to call to the dying queen. So this is Anna realizing what Dido did, yelling up to her. It came to this, then, sister. You deceived me. The pier meant this. Altars and fires meant this. What shall I mourn first, being abandoned? Did you scorn your sister's company in death? You should have called me out to the same fate. The same blade's edge and hurt at the same hour should have taken us off. With my own hands had I to build this fire, and had I to call upon our country's gods, that in the end, was you placed on it there? Oh, heartless one, I should be absent. You have put to death yourself and me, the people and the fathers, bred in Sidon, and your new city. Give me fresh water. Let me bathe her wound and catch upon my lips any last breath hovering over hers. So she wants to hear any last words. So she climbs up to Dido. Now she had climbed the topmost steps and took her dying sister into her arms to cherish with a sob, using her dress to stanch the dark blood flow. But Dido, trying to lift her heavy eyes, fainted again. Her chest wound whistled air. Three times she struggled up on one elbow, and each time fell back on the bed. Her gaze went wavering as she looked for heaven's light and groaned at finding it. Almighty Juno, filled with pity for this long ordeal and difficult passage, now sent Iris down out of Olympus to set free the wrestling spirit for the body's hold. So Iris is sending down a messenger, or Juno sending down Iris, the female messenger god, to get her spirit from the body's hold, which is actually kind of interesting that it might suggest a belief in an immortal spirit. For since she died not at her fated span, nor as she merited, but before her time, inflamed and driven mad, Proserpina, that's the queen of the underworld, had not yet plucked from her the golden hair, delivering her to Orcus in the underworld of the Styx. So humid Iris thought bright heaven flew on saffron, yellow wings. Through bright heaven flew on saffron yellow wings, and in her train a thousand hues shimmered before the sun. At Dido's head she came to rest. This token, sacred to Dis, Dis is the same as Hades or Pluto, this token, sacred to Dis, I bear away as bidden and free you from your body. Saying this, she cut a lock of Dido's hair. Along with it, her body's warmth fell into dislocation, and out into the winds her life withdrew. So Dido dies.